Ricky Jackson spent 39 years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit. He finally was exonerated after the only witness against him recanted his testimony decades after the original trial. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Ricky Jackson tells his story in a documentary called Lovely Jackson that's now streaming on Prime Video. He joins me now. Thanks so much for being here, Ricky.
Thank you for having me. A pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. And also with us today is Brian Howe, a University of Cincinnati professor of clinical law at the Ohio Innocence Project and a member of Ricky's legal team. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Ricky, you were 18 when you were convicted and sentenced to die for this crime you didn't commit. Can you take us back to the day of this murder and what happened, what you were doing?
Yes, I can. I just want to say hi to my good friend, Brian.
Hi, Ricky.
How you doing, buddy?
Good.
Like you said, I was 18. I just turned 18, practically. And there was a neighborhood store, a little bodega in my neighborhood that was robbed. One person was critically injured, and another person was shot also, but she survived her wounds. And long story short, myself and my two friends somehow got blamed for committing this crime by a kid in our neighborhood that we didn't find out till later on had been coerced by police, people that were involved in the crime. He just pretty much made the stuff up, and the police, for whatever strange reason, ran with this cockamamie story that the three of us robbed this store, killed this man, and also killed another human being. Mm.
And you spent 3 years on death row, Ricky, before your sentence was commuted to life in prison. I know you say in the documentary that leaving death row was a relief, but entering the general prison population had plenty of challenges, right?
That is correct. Yes, yes. 3.5 years on death row. I came perilously close to my own execution, actually. But, you know, at that time, the Ohio death penalty law was in flux. They were, you know, bickering back and forth whether what was constitutional and what was not. And fortunate for myself and a lot of guys, men and women on death row throughout Ohio, you know, were given life sentences, were commuted from death to life in prison.
But what was it like to then be in prison in the general population? I mean, that's a very different world.
As I stated in the docudrama, you know, like being on death row, you had a certain set of worries. But, you know, out in the general population, which at the time, Lucasville was one of the most dangerous prisons in the state of Ohio. It was super max. It was the first super max in the state of Ohio. And I was 21. I'm not a big guy to begin with. And this, they were telling me that this was the rest of my life. Mm. You know, and so I had to navigate those waters. I ended up in like 10 different prisons throughout my 39-year odyssey. They shipped me all over the state. But yeah, being in general population, you saw a lot of things that you know, that you just can't erase from your mind. You know, you have to live with this day on a constant basis for 39 years. Mm.
Were you in Lucasville during the riots there?
Luckily, my security had just gotten lowered, and I got rolled out of there to another prison a couple of months before that riot happened.
Oh,
but
wow.
The tension was so thick, even before the actual events, you know, everybody just sensed that something, the place was about to explode. There was so much tension in there, you know.
Brian, Ricky explains in this film that he wrote letters about his case to everybody he could think of, including the Ohio Innocence Project, when he learned about the project. What about Ricky's case got the attention of the Ohio Innocence Project? Because I'm sure you all get letters, tons of letters from people you can't help.
Yes. And so we first got the application from Ricky in 2006. Though that was before my time, actually, at the Ohio Innocence Project. But OIP is a legal clinic, so it is run by law students. Students are evaluating the application. Students are doing the investigation. These are UC law students. And they were the ones who really began investigating the case, obtained the transcripts, obtain the police reports. And I think the more that they and we began looking into this, I mean, the more apparent it was, even just based on the record itself, that this was a problematic conviction.
Because that boy from the neighborhood who was 12 at the time, who, as Ricky said, made up this testimony, I mean, his testimony changed throughout the trial, didn't it? It seemed like there were red flags even at the time.
I mean, it not only changed throughout the investigation and leading up to Ricky's trial, but there were three co-defendants in this case. They each had separate trials. His testimony was significantly different across all three trials. At one point, he said that he was on a city bus and that Wiley, who was supposedly driving the getaway car, pulled up next to the bus and waved to him seconds before they all jumped out and committed this crime. I mean, you could just go on and on about the inconsistencies and sort of the nonsense in the testimony.
Well, and Brian, Ricky's conviction centered on the testimony of this boy who was only 12 at the time of the crime. He eventually admitted that he felt pressured to lie. He was coerced, as Ricky just said. It seems like that would make it pretty straightforward to get the conviction overturned, but you explain in the film that it's not that simple, is it?
No, courts are very, very reluctant after the fact to re-examine a person's guilt or innocence. You know, I mean, it's one thing if you can show a pure procedural defect, if you can prove, for example, that someone didn't receive a fair trial for some reason, that their constitutional rights were violated. In terms of going back and actually taking another look at the merits of the case, a person's guilt or innocence, courts are very, very reluctant to do that. Mm-hmm. And even when in this case, you know, as in this case, when we have, I think, pretty compelling testimony. I mean, Ed Vernon's recantation was extremely credible. You know, he was able to explain exactly what did happen. You know, unlike his original testimony, it was perfectly consistent with everything else. And, you know, he came forward really at some cost to himself. He was not excited about coming back to court.
Sure. We're talking with an Ohio man who spent 39 years locked up for a crime he didn't commit. He tells his story in a film called Lovely Jackson. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Ricky, one of the things that really struck me in the film was that you had several parole hearings while you were in prison, and the parole board said every time, you need to admit to this crime and you know, maybe we can reduce your sentence. Were you ever tempted to confess to this crime you didn't commit just to get out of prison?
Almost every time I was about to go see the parole board, you know, as you know, as time started ticking by and, you know, I've just been in prison since I was 18. You know, I'm 30 something now, I'm 40, I'm 50. And every time, you know, I walked into that room, I'd made up my mind that I was just going to give them what they want, you know. But I don't know. It was just my mother. I could always hear my mother's voice in the back of my head. And she was like, stick with what you know. You know, stick with what you know. Don't venture off into something you don't know about. You didn't do this. And that's what you got to stand on. And really, that was the only card I had to play anyway. You know, I couldn't tell you about something that I never took part in, you know. And it was always like that, all my parole hearings, you know. Great prison record, did a lot of things in prison, started a lot of programs. But it was always that one thing that they wanted to hear that I couldn't give them.
Ricky, 39 years behind bars. I mean, you just talked about, you know, your 20s, your 30s, your 40s. Tell us how you describe that amount of time in the film and what you lost during that time.
Well, since being out, you know, in prison, it's hard to see what you lost, you know, because I was just 18. I was just starting my life, but outside of my family, I really didn't have a lot except for my dreams and aspirations of what I wanted to do with my life, you know. And those are just a few of the things that they took from me, you know. They used to make an argument about when I was getting compensation about my zip code and that a black kid like me and what was the average I was going to make in a lifetime. And that's how they was adding up my life, you know. And you don't know what potential lies inside of a person based on their zip code or the color of their skin. You know, you just don't, you know, and that's how they try to categorize my life, you know. But
what kept you going, Ricky?
My mother, the fact that I was innocent, you know, I mean, it was a lot of times that I really wanted to just give up and die, you know, but it was just something. Every time I got to my lowest of lowest, I had this little trick I used to do in prison. I would take a rock and put it inside of my shoe and, you know, and I would walk the yard. And I would walk the yard, and this rock was just digging into my soul. But it, I don't know, it just brought me back somehow and made me start thinking about the pain in my foot instead I was going through that particular day, you know?
Wow. Brian, you know, in addition to this witness who lied about Ricky, there was a witness who said all along that Ricky was not involved in this crime, that his two friends were not involved in this crime. How important was she in the case?
Yeah, and actually there were multiple witnesses who contradicted Ed Verdon's story even at the time of the original trial. One witness was a young woman from the neighborhood who had gone into the store and seen the two perpetrators who were sort of loitering outside the entrance to the store when she went in. She knew Ricky Jackson. She knew Kwame and Wiley. And she knew that these two men who were outside were not any of the three of them. She testified even at the original trial. The jury did not believe her, apparently. There were other witnesses at the original trial, including almost a half a dozen witnesses who were with Ed Verdon. These were other school children who testified that they were with Ed Verdon on a separate school bus that was over three blocks away from the shooting when it happened. And these children came into court, testified that he was with them. Ricky was still convicted and sentenced to death.
It's just, you hear that and it's kind of, it's unbelievable. I mean, it sounds like something from a fiction, you know, but the woman I'm thinking of, I think her name's Karen Smith, and,
yes,
and she's in the docudrama. She talks about almost feeling guilty that she wasn't believed and couldn't do more. But it sounds like the prosecutor in the case that you brought that exonerated Ricky found her really credible, that she was in some ways more convincing than Ed Verdon for this prosecutor. Was she important in that case, do you think?
Yeah, she was the young lady who had gone into the store and see the... So, you know, I mean, I think it was... She was incredibly, I think, powerful in the evidentiary hearing for the motion for new trial. But really, all of the testimony, all of the facts, everything that had been known to police... and everything that we were able to present, it all pointed in the same direction, which is that the testimony that Ed Verdon offered in 1975 that led to Ricky's conviction and sentence to death was false.
Mm. Ricky, even at that final hearing, right before you won your freedom, prosecutors offered you a deal that you could walk free again if you admitted to the crime. Did you consider that even for a minute?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I felt like me, you know, it was a miracle that I got that far, you know, to have my case back in court. And I knew that was my last shot. I really felt that. And I just sacrificed and given up too much to just cop out like that. You know, if this was going to be my fate, then whatever, just let the cards fall where they may. But I just come too far to even think about it at that point.
Brian, as one of Ricky's lawyers, was there any part of you that thought maybe he should take that deal?
Oh, you know, I it's not an uncommon thing when you're, especially when you have a strong case. And I mean, you know, it's, no one should have any illusions that the right thing tends to happen in these cases, or that the system is somehow self-correcting. I mean, you know, even the best cases that we have are maybe a coin flip, depending on how it plays out. So, you know, I've never once, you know, recommended one way or the other to a client in that situation. I just don't know how I would even start to make that. It's something that people have to decide for themselves. And I think Ricky, consistent with his strength as a person and his willingness and desire to continue to fight for his innocence. I have a lot of respect for him for moving forward with that fight, but I wouldn't have blamed him if he had taken the deal.
Yeah. Ricky, it's been more than a decade since your release in 2014. We got an email from Janelle, one of our listeners, who asks, what are the resources available for someone in a situation like Ricky's? Who helps once you get out? What kind of resources were available to you, Ricky, to help rebuild your life?
Practically none. If it wasn't for private entities and people like OIP, when I first got out, I didn't have an ID. Let me back up a little bit. As an innocent person and you get exonerated, you're not entitled to anything from the state as far as like ID. If I was guilty, I could have gotten into a lot of programs, food subsidies, vouchers, housing, stuff like that. But as an innocent person, they have no obligation to you whatsoever. You know, so
that
they was just like.
That seems bad. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, ma'am, it doesn't. But, you know. That's what an exonerated person goes through. And like, since I've gotten out, you know, Ohio has some compensation laws on the books, as do a lot of other states, but they've weakened them so much, you know, and it's really hard, you know, even after you get exonerated and claim to be free, you still have to go through a lot of hurdles and still in court battles, trying to get some compensation for the wrong that has been done you, you know. But to get back to your question, we get nothing, you know, outside of help from friends, families, and strangers, GoFundMe accounts, you know. That, like I said, the state isn't entitled to give us anything.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I mean, you know, the programs that are in place for people who are returning from prison, you know, they're not perfect, but there is a process that people go through in order to get an identification, in order to get set up with the social worker and who can connect them with various programs. For people who are exonerated, like Ricky, the conviction is overturned and they are returned in a legal sense to where they were prior to the conviction. So they are back, you know, as if they were never convicted in the first place. And so the ironic thing is that a lot of those programs are not available for people in Ricky's situation, and they do end up often in a harder spot than they would just returning home having served their sentence.
Ricky, you mentioned compensation. I think I read that you've gotten more than $11 million in compensation from the state of Ohio, from the city of Cleveland for your wrongful imprisonment. But I mean, can any amount of money make up for those years you lost?
Definitely not, you know. And when I'm out about and with friends and family and they start talking about the past and the things that they used to do, you know, I feel dumbfounded just sitting there and having to listen to the conversation with a smile on my face. But I don't even know what I'm smiling about because I never got a chance to experience any of that, you know.
How are you doing now, Ricky? You're married, right? And you have a daughter.
Making my own memories now. Yes. Yes, I do. I mean, life has been great, you know, because I have everything in life that I used to dream about in prison, honestly. You know what I'm saying? Honestly, I do. You know, I have a beautiful family. I got three knucklehead stepkids and then lovely Rose, and those stepkids are dropping grandbabies out to the house all day.
Keeping so, you busy, huh?
Yes. And this docudrama has allowed me to travel and spread this, you know, not just my story, but it gives me an opportunity to listen to other people and stuff that they've gone through. You know, because people always ask me, how did I survive? You know, and I always say, like, there's nothing in me that's not in you. You know what I'm saying? You'd be surprised you know, at the things you can conquer, you know, when you your back is really to the wall, you know.
I think that's awfully generous of you, Ricky. I watched this film and I thought there seems to be something real special about you.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just like, I'm so happy and grateful to be alive because I know there are countless other people that will never get to feel this joy, that have walked the same shoes I walked in, you know? And a lot of them are not going to make it this far, you know? I was very fortunate and blessed, you know, to be around such a good team like Brian Howe and people that believe in you. And that's the most important thing.
And we are very grateful that you've been with us. I've been talking with Ohio exoneree Ricky Jackson and University of Cincinnati and Ohio Innocence Project Professor of Clinical Law, Brian Howe. Thank you both for your time today. The documentary Lovely Jackson is streaming now on Prime Video. We have a link on our website, wvxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer, Selena Reeder, associate producers, Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.